It is Sunday, February 24th, 2013, and this is the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. Boy, what a week it has been in the world of information security. Certainly, the story that everybody's talking about this week is definitely a very serious and really stunning realization that Jeep and Burger King had their Twitter accounts hacked. Actually pretty hilarious. Hopefully everybody got to see those. I think both Burger King and Jeep benefited pretty dramatically in terms of Twitter followers from that. Obviously, that's not the big news. We'll get to that later. The next thing is that NBC.com's site was hacked and was configured to inject an iframe, which directed visitors to an exploit kit that delivered the Citadel Trojan. This is pretty significant news. Many millions of people, as you can imagine, visit them pretty regularly. So I haven't heard any scale of numbers of infected systems, but I've got to believe it's pretty significant. I think this highlights a trend for everybody that really shows malicious sites are not really constrained to those stereotypical pornography and wear sites. It's really mainstream now, and the attackers are actually going where the people are because they're motivated to do that. Constraining themselves to, for instance, porn sites kind of limits their demographics. So in my day job, I think a lot about this kind of problem. And, you know, right as this was happening, I think I found out probably an hour or so after it started happening. I took a look at the rating engine of a web filtering tool that we deployed, and I'm not going to mention the name, but what was interesting is the sites referenced in the iframes were categorized as malicious, even though they had been just registered earlier that day. So they hadn't been on the site. They hadn't been on the internet for very long. And NBC.com itself was listed as suspicious. So I think what that points out is that for the most part, if you have in your environment some kind of web filtering technology that blocks malicious and suspicious types of sites, you're going to catch a lot of these. Now, certainly, there was probably a period of time where that web filtering engine wasn't catching them, but you can only do so much. If you are going to allow your employees to be on the internet, it is a possibility that they're going to get infected, and you're really reliant on pieces of technology which are not perfect, good but not perfect, and so you're living with some inherent risk there. And the name of the game is, how do we minimize the risk? Okay, moving on to a story I talked about last week, which is that Bit9 was hacked. The original story reported by Brian Krebs was that Bit9 became aware early in January that they were hacked and some of their certificates, or I guess it was a certificate, was stolen by an attacker and used to sign some malware. And the intention was that the signed malware would actually bypass the Bit9 application whitelisting engine because the attacker was trying to target some third-party entity who used Bit9 as part of their protection. In the latest episode of John Strand's Hack Naked TV, I think you really pointed out something very relevant, and that's that the attacker found, apparently, that the Bit9 defenses at their target entity were such that they actually had to find a way around them by signing their malware with a certificate so that it could get past the Bit9 whitelisting engine. And And that actually does, you know, so long as we all understand it right, does point out that application whitelisting is a pretty effective control, as long as the vendors are able to keep control of their certificates. So the new news here is that Bit9 released some hashes of the malware that was signed with their certificates, and Brian Krebs did a little more research on VirusTotal and found that the malware associated with those hashes were actually first detected back in July 2012, and I guess signed and compiled back in that time frame as well. Bit9, in Brian Krebs' latest article, apparently points to a virtual machine that was, what sounds to me like, out of date, was spun up by a Bit9 employee, and that virtual machine had some older Bit9 signing certificates loaded on it, and apparently didn't have all the right protections on it, and the method of entry was apparently SQL injection, which kind of says to me it apparently was an internet-facing system. There really isn't a lot more detail at this point, but Bit9 apparently is going to be releasing some more information. It was allegedly going to be released last Thursday. However, I just checked and their blog is saying that the forensics are continuing and they expect to make a post this coming week. All right, next are two stories that really point to risks with business partners and vendors. First is that Zendesk was hacked and some of their client data was leaked. I don't think it was extremely sensitive. It was things like email addresses, names, and subject lines of support tickets. And that impacted Twitter, Pinterest, and Tumblr. Apparently, Zendesk provides help desk services for tech companies like those. The other story was that cPanel is hacked. And apparently this server that was hacked actually is part of their support infrastructure, where they keep root passwords or other logon credentials to customer web servers. cPanel is kind of an interesting case, and I in fact actually use them as well, where if you have a support problem, one of the mainline support avenues is that you provide cPanel, the company, with your root password, and their engineers get onto your system and take care of whatever problem you have. And that works really well, especially in the web hosting world where, you know, all of the money and profit has been kind of eked out. So you have these companies running major farms of systems, and so this support model is kind of organically grown, and you know, it works until the server that is housing those passwords gets compromised and the data is stolen. And as you can kind of think, that's a treasure trove of information for an attacker, because potentially that provides access to conceivably thousands of different systems. As far as I have seen, there's been no public statement about how much data that was stolen, but I could easily see this being quite a number of systems. And I understand a lot of people may not be particularly excited about this or these two stories, but the interesting thing to me is this points out the risk that supply chain and vendors impart onto your organization. And specifically, their bad security or their lack of security or even their differential in security practices from your own potentially put your business at risk, even if you are doing everything right. If you're relying on business partners who aren't as stringent as you are, they become the weakest link, potentially depending on the nature of the relationship you have with them. But it really points out that in a security program, vendors and suppliers need to be considered, and a lot of diligence and attention needs to be paid to them to ensure they are living up to the standards you need them to based on the risk they pose to your operations. Okay, moving on to the major headline of the week, which certainly was Mandiant's release of the APT1 report. I've had the chance to go through and read it front to back, and it's very interesting from many different angles. Over the months and years, a lot of people have been very, very critical of Mandiant and their propensity to pin things on China. And, you know, I suspect for a number of reasons, Mandiant found it necessary to release this report, probably not the least of which is to hopefully somehow change governmental relations between the U.S. and China based on their perception of economic espionage. I will say it has probably created more buzz around a security company than I have ever seen or could ever have imagined. So from a marketing standpoint, it probably is really going to turn out to be a boon for them. And having read the report, I think they do make a very compelling case that there is some sort of association between the actors behind these APT attacks and the Chinese government. I think there have been a couple of really good rebuttals, I think most popularly by Jeffrey Carr. However, I don't think you can really dismiss the whole concept out of hand. We all understand the challenges of attribution, but when you do have a preponderance of data that seems to hang together, Occam's razor says it probably is the most simple explanation. Okay, so moving on from the actual report itself to the content, there's a couple of interesting things I think that I want to talk about here. And, you know, number one is I think we should take more focus on the tactics and less on the motivations and maybe the actors. And I say that for a couple of specific reasons. You know, I'm very well aware that targeted attacks do happen. I am very aware that governments participate in them, the extent to which we may never really know. However, there are some common themes that hang together between both these targeted attacks done by intelligence organizations and your run-of-the-mill crime syndicates, phishing, and other types of attackers who are less sophisticated. They all seem to use somewhat similar tactics that we ought to be defending against. For instance, Mandiant reports that most of the intrusions happen by way of spear phishing against the employees of the victim organizations. And the report goes into some pretty interesting details that describes how these phishing attacks work. And there are some important distinctions between these more sophisticated attacks and what I think we see on some of the more run-of-the-mill phishing attacks. However, I think the delineation between the two continues to gray. So, for instance, in Mandiant's report, they point out that the main tactic in spear phishing is to craft letters or emails from someone the victim knows. So maybe it is a supervisor or a business unit executive or the company president. And in fact, they go on to show a spear phishing email that they believe came from the actors of APT1 that apparently came from the Mandiant CEO out to some of their employees, except it didn't come from an internal mail server. It came from a free external email service. And the email was more or less written in a fashion that was believable, had materially relevant content, and prompted the employees to actually open an attachment, which of course contains some malware. And I think the way they tied this particular phishing attack to the APT1 actors was by taking a look at the malware they received and being able to associate that back with some things they had investigated previously. So once they have your employees clicking on emails from their managers, the attackers are installing remote access Trojans and then continuing to move throughout the organization. Once they have a footprint on the company's network, some things I think I've observed and were inferred through the report is that Active Directory seems to be an enabler to some of these attacks, allowing them to move fairly seamlessly throughout the organization. So they get a footprint on one system, and that in turn allows them to, through hash stealing and pass the hash types attacks and some other mechanisms, to plant malware around in different corners of the networks. I suspect even if Active Directory weren't in place, once you have an attacker with a footprint on an employee workstation, it becomes relatively easy to leverage that employee's legitimate email to propagate some malware out to his or her coworkers with even less suspicion, because now it's actually coming from the actual mail server run by the organization. So I've been thinking a lot about what this report from Mandiant actually tells us. And here's more or less what I've come up with. Number one is a lot can be learned from performing forensic investigations. You can definitely see by reading the report, they learned a lot about the nature of the attackers, how they work, what they're after, who they're associated with, and so on. The next thing I take away from the report is that we have to come to terms with the actual problem. In security, we seem to be having this kabuki dance where we feel like we just have to find the next level of control or silver bullet to allow things to continue on, and that's okay. But I think there's some structural problems with the design of our operation that we have to come to terms with, or we just have to accept that there's some inherent risk and there's not a lot you can do about it. So the first observation I have is that humans are susceptible to phishing, and there isn't anything you can do about that. Now, I'm not advocating that we throw up our hands and say it's not worth trying to educate people on how to detect and avoid them, but the reality is these are becoming far more sophisticated. They are increasingly relying on trust relationships that people have with other people. And there's some elements of human psychology here at play, which I just don't think we really have any hope of changing. The next problem I see is that there just aren't any effective technical measures that prevent successful phishing. Anti-spam and antivirus just aren't cutting it. And nor do I expect that they really will ever be able to cut it. If you keep in mind that in particular with targeted attacks, the attackers are going to monkey with whatever they're attacking you with until it's able to get around the defenses you have in place. So kind of by its very nature, it is intended to get around those defenses. The next observation I have is not directly related to the APT1 report, but certainly material to some of the other stories we talked about, and that's that we can't control whether websites that our people visit are serving up exploits. We don't control the security of NBC.com. We don't control the security of many of the websites which we might generally deem to be safe or benign. And because of that, we have an inherent risk. And as I mentioned before, antivirus is not effective at catching serious threats from different kinds of malware, whether it's coming down from a malicious website or from an email or a USB drive or what have you. It's just not an entirely effective solution. Depending on whose number you believe, it's somewhere between 3% and 50% effective. In any event, it's not a reliable control. I wouldn't bet my life on the ability of it to stop a new virus. And the last structural problem we have is that there's a constant stream of zero days against software that exists on the workstations of our employees. And so my point is, these are structural problems with our environment that really aren't going to change. We can't influence them. They're out of our control. And yet they directly contribute to the effectiveness of attacks against our companies. And so, as I mentioned, I've been thinking a lot about this because I worry about this for a constituency of people who perform fairly sensitive functions as part of their daily jobs, and it's a fairly significant population of people. And so by the law of large numbers, we're, you know, potentially going to see lots of bad things happen over time, and hence we need to make sure we're ahead of the game. I see two avenues of attacking the solution, and the first is by avoidance. And by that I mean, don't permit things that are problematic from entering your environment at all. If I have a sensitive business process, why do I think, given the context of these structural problems, that it isn't extraordinarily problematic to let people use computers to perform this sensitive process, work with this sensitive data, exist on this sensitive network, and then gripe when bad things happen? So I know this is going to be completely heretical, but if you are worried about APT style attacks and your data is in fact that sensitive, why would you allow people to go to the internet from that network? Why would I allow people to check their email on a system that is processing sensitive data when I know that some percentage of their emails are malicious? Either they're, you know, generic phishing emails, they're just run-of-the-mill malware attachments, or in fact targeted attacks. So from my perspective, one viable option is to make the work computer, in quotes, very utilitarian for the purposes of performing a specific business task. And things that induce risk, such as surfing on the internet, checking email, maybe checking only email from the outside, would have to be performed somewhere else. Not on that system, not on that network, not where it has access to allow an attacker to get to your crown jewels. And so if you say, well, that's just totally unreasonable, I agree, it is pretty unreasonable given the context of the world we work in today. However, rejecting that is essentially accepting some amount of risk, whether you like it or not. On the one hand, you can't say there is not a technological solution to this problem, and I'm not going to take steps to address it. You basically are saying, look, I accept the risk. Another strategy is what I call minimization. And as an alternative to avoidance, it's really focused at how do we minimize the opportunity for successful attacks. And, but you know, I thought about this in the context of avoidance really not being practical for most organizations, but a minimization strategy might look like having application whitelisting installed, having very strict web filtering installed. Maybe it's whitelisting instead of blacklisting, isolating sensitive things or risky things into virtual machines. So last week I talked about Nick's solution about running Java inside a virtual workstation in the cloud. Great idea. If you're not running Java on your workstation, you don't have that threat. If you have Java in a contained environment where you have some very tight controls around where it has access to connect to, that's a reasonable situation. It's going to be expensive, but it's reasonable. You know, also taking a system integrity proactive monitoring type approach where you're looking at tripwire type file changes. You are proactively looking at logs and basically acting on anomalies to minimize the damage that's done if someone does happen to get in. Now look, I'm not saying that everybody has to do one of these things. I know it's not reasonable, it's not practical, it's probably not practical for nearly anybody. But my point is that we can't sit back and complain about how ineffective our tool set is to command or conquer the threat that we're faced with. There are options, they're just really unpalatable options that we as business leaders generally aren't willing to make. Now, I understand that what I just talked about was really centered on user computing and really doesn't address at all the concept of infrastructure type security. You know, I'm really more on the point of the personal computer used by employees and the risk that they pose given their activities. I have a whole other rant about the other side of security. In any event, hopefully that was a useful thought exercise. It's certainly been something I've been thinking about for a while. And the Mandiant report and some of the other things that happened over the past week really put it into perspective for me. Well, in any event, I'm bumping up against my bedtime. Tomorrow is going to be the start of a fairly challenging week at work. So I am going to cut this off now, and I really hope everybody has a great week. And I definitely enjoy talking about these stories. I remind everybody, if you have any feedback, any questions, anything you'd like me to talk about, whatever, just send me an email at info@defensivesecurity.org or @defensivesec on Twitter. And I will talk to you again next week. Have a great one. Bye.